Okay, we'll start with something from the beginning of the Sedra that also has connection to the end of the Sedra. It says that the Mitzrim put Klal Yisrael to work with Avodas Perech, literally work that breaks you. How much work is it that the threshold of work that's breaking work and debilitating work and work that's work? So there is a halachic definition of Avodas Perech, because there is a prohibition in the Torah, Lo sirdenu beferech le'inecha. You're not allowed to work in Eved Ivri Avodas Perech. So there has to be some kind of qualification what that is. So the Rambam says that Avodas Perech is work that has no purpose to it, purposeless work. Or work that has no end to it, because if it has no end, it has no purpose. That's called Avodas Perech. You can have very, very hard work, but if there's a purpose to it, if there's some kind of goal, that in itself is exhilarating. But a person who works and he sees no benefit, no result from his work, that's the most kind of debilitating work there can be. There's a story told of a Soviet prisoner, and he was confined for 10 years to a cell, and there was a handle in the cell that came out of the wall that he was told is connected to a mill on the other side of the wall, and his job is to turn this handle and turn the mill and grind wheat for the motherland. And he did this every day, 10 hours a day, for 10 years. And finally, they let him out. And he said before he goes free, he would like to just see on the other side of the wall the mill that he was turning all these years. And they started laughing, and they took him to the other side of the wall, and the handle was connected to nothing. He said that it was more painful to him to see that in the 10 years he accomplished absolutely nothing by turning that handle than being in prison for 10 years. So that's called Avodas Perech. In fact, I think there's a hint. There's a Mefarshim bring down for a different reason. In a completely different context, but I'm going to use it for my purposes. They say that Perech in Esbash. Esbash is the gematria where you exchange Aleph for Tav, Beis for Shin, and so on. So in Esbash, Perech, the letters that are exchanged is Vav, Gimel, Lamed. The Pei becomes a Vav, and the Reish becomes a Gimel, and the Chaf becomes a Lamed. What does that mean? Absolutely nothing. Except if you add up those letters, Vav, Gimel, and Lamed, you get 39, which represents the 39 Melachos of Shabbos. According to what we just said, what Perech is, the idea is very simple. The Melachos of Shabbos are the Melachos that went into building the Mishkan. They are Melacha with the greatest goal, the greatest purpose that could be. These are the 39 Melachos that eventually end up creating a Mishkan where the Ribbono Shel Olam's presence exists through that Mishkan. So the Esbash, the antithesis of Perech, is the Lamed Tes Melachos of Shabbos. Perech is work without any goal, without any result, and Lamed Tes Melachos Shabbos is work with the greatest result. It would seem that that is the case. That's what the kind of work it says, that they built Ore Miskinos Lefaro. The simple meaning of Miskinos is that they were storehouse, store cities. But the Medrash says, Al Tikre Miskinos Ela Miskenos. They were pitiful cities. They built them on sand, and when they were built, they fell in, and they had to build them again. They never saw a benefit. They never saw an accomplishment. They were constantly rebuilding these cities. And Paro understood that that kind of work is debilitating. That kind of work is going to keep them with a slave mentality. They're not going to be able to think of any kind of accomplishment if all you do every day is work without any accomplishment, where you don't see any results from the work or lasting results. With that, you can understand the following. In the end of the Sedra, Paro says that the Jews are lazy. They have plenty of time on their hands to think about things like going out of Egypt. So he wants to keep them busy. So he says, I'm not going to give you any more straw, and you're going to have to produce the same quota of bricks that you did before when I gave you the straw. Achor Paro wasn't stupid. If I was Paro, I would make them produce double the quota of bricks. What's the difference? And according to the first way, Paro gained nothing. They were producing the same exact quota they had before. But if I make them work harder and produce double the quota, at least Paro will get double the bricks too. So why did he choose not to give them straw so they'd have to work harder and produce the same amount? Why not just make it that they should produce more? But that's exactly the idea. Paro didn't want them to give them any satisfaction of feeling they accomplished something. Going to work twice as hard and accomplish nothing more. And that is part of what Avodas Perach is. Which brings me to the following. It would seem that women's work is many times Avodas Perach. Because you don't see any lasting result, right? A woman cleans the house. And pretty much soon it becomes dirty again. And you have to clean it again. Right? I remember when I was young and my wife was young, we had many young children running around the house. I would leave the house in the morning and it looked like a hurricane hit it. And when I came back at night, it looked the same way. So I said to my wife, what'd you do all day? And she said, you won't believe this, but I cleaned up the house and it was perfectly in order. And the kids came home from school and turned it upside down again. And sometimes I believed her, and Lamai said, that's the truth. So you can work hard and not see any lasting results. You clean clothes and they're worn and get dirty again. They have to clean the same clothes again. You cook a meal and you don't frame it and put it in a museum. People eat it. Then it's gone. You have to cook another meal. So it would seem that that kind of work is Avodas Perach, but it's not. Because the goal of all that work is not the meal or the nice house or the clean clothing. That's just a means to reach an end. The end is creating a family. And that you do see results, especially over the long run. So if a person understands that the work that they're doing is not the goal in itself, it's a means to reach the goal. The goal is to create a functioning Torah home. And these are part of the means to do that. But it's not an end in itself, then even that kind of work is not debilitating. Because in the end, you see a result from all of it. But if your goal is clean clothing, nice meal, tidy house, then that could have the negative perspective of being Avodas Perach. Okay. Next. Vatirena hamiyaldos eso elokim. Velo osu kasher diber aleim melech Mitzrayim. Paro commands the midwives to kill little babies. And they fear the Rabbanu Shel Olam and don't kill these little babies. So Tozer Rosh Yeshiva asked, you need to be a Yirei Shamayim not to kill little babies? You have to be a mensch. You have to be a human being not to kill little babies. You don't have to be a God-fearing person. Right. So why does it say Vatirena hamiyaldos esu Elokim? They feared God and therefore they didn't kill the little babies. Says it tells Rosh Yeshiva, you see from here that without fear of God, you can kill little babies too, even if you're a mensch. The Nazis were refined, very sophisticated, advanced people, and they killed little babies because if you base your morality on your own thought, your own ideas, then you can distort anything. Human beings can take the most horrid things and make them the most righteous things. If you classify Jews as roaches and as a blight to society, then ethnic cleansing becomes a mitzvah. It becomes something that is proper and refined to kill little babies. unless you have a fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he's the one who creates the standards for morality, then a human being can do anything. Avraham Avinu said the same thing to Avimelech. Ki amarti ein yiras Elokim b'makom hazeh v'haraguni al dvar ishti. If you depend on human morality, today what is moral, tomorrow could be immoral, and vice versa. In the 1960s, they created a new morality on the college campuses. The new morality was very, very similar to the old immorality. Except once they called it new and made it moral, it became moral. They didn't say it's the old immorality, they didn't want to be immoral. So they created a new standard, a new definition of what morality was, very, very similar to the old immorality, but if you call it new morality, it's fine. That is the ability for people to distort law, order, justice, and morality. And that, I don't remember if we mentioned it, I'll mention it now. That's what happened in Sodom. Sodom had courts, and they had judges, except the judges' names were Sheker, Chazov, right? Those were the names of the judges. The Gemara gives a very cute story, but it brings out a very serious message. It says Eliezer once went to Sodom, and he was mugged. He was beaten up. And Eliezer was a gibor, so he got up and he chased his assailants and caught them. And he dragged them before a judge. The judge's name was Sheker. And the judge said, "What's the problem here?" So he said, "This man, mugged me, he beat me up, and I want justice done." So the judge said to Eliezer, "Did he make you bleed?" He said, "Yes." He said, "In that case, you owe him $50 for bloodletting." Because in those days, letting blood was considered a therapeutic thing. So Eliezer was not a fool. Eliezer punches the judge in the mouth, makes him bleed, and says, "Look, whatever you owe me, pay him." So, what's the point, besides being a nice story? The point is that Sodom was not a lawless place. It wasn't a place of anarchy. It was a place with laws, but the laws were crooked. The laws were distorted. And that's what a human being can do. A human being can take murdering little children and make it into a mitzvah if you base your morality on what you want and what you see. So therefore it says, "Vatirena hamiyaldo sesu Elokim." Only because they feared God didn't they kill these little children. Otherwise they would have found a million different justifications for doing what Paro wanted them to do. Okay. Next. We may have discussed this idea way back in Parshas Bereishis, but I don't remember. But I'm going to mention it again because it's an important idea. It says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, Vatirehu Kitov, she saw he was good. Vatitzbeneu Shlosha Yorachim. And she hid him for 3 months. Now, what's the reason she hid him for 3 months? Because if she didn't hide him, and the Egyptians discovered him, they would drown him. Okay. So why does that depend on her seeing that he was good? And if he wouldn't be good, he'd be a little brat, she would say, "Come and drown this little brat." Right? Obviously, whether he's good or not, a mother is not going to want her child drowned. So why does the Torah make the fact that Yocheved hid Moshe dependent on the Tireo Kitov? So the Medrashim say, she saw the Shekhinah with him, there was a light in the house, she saw he was born with a bris, whatever it was, those are Medrashim. What is the simple meaning of the pasuk? She saw he was good, and therefore she hid him for 3 months. So way back in the beginning of Bereishis, the Torah says also, Vayar Elokim Kitov, God saw it was good. And there also, you can't understand it literally because it doesn't make any sense. The Rabbanu Shem said, "Let there be fish." And then he took a look and he said, "Hey, looks pretty good. Looks like fish. Not bad. Did a good, pretty good job." Right? That's absurd. The Rabbanu Shem knew exactly what he was doing. He knew it exactly how it was going to turn out. He didn't have to look at it and say, "Hey, looks pretty good." Pat himself on the back. Rabbi Arulukim Kito. Looks okay to me. So what does it mean? Says the Ramban. What it means is the following. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates things, He wills them into being with speech, in our terms. Hu Omar Vayehi, Bidvar Hashem Shomayim Nasu. The Rabban Hashem creates with speech. But that brings the thing into creation, brings it into existence. What gives it the power to continue to exist? So Vayar Elokim, the Rabban Hashem looks at it, just as much as when he speaks, it brings it into being, in our terms. The Rabban Hashem doesn't speak, he doesn't have speech like we do. But in our terms, the way the Rabban Hashem creates is as if through speech. And when the Rabban Hashem looks at it, it gives it the ability to continue to exist. Tov means something substantial that has the ability to continue to exist. And therefore, the more it can exist, the more Tov it is. And therefore, that which is eternal is the ultimate Tov. Olam Haba is called Yom Shekulo Tov, because it is eternal. That's Tov. Hodu Lashem Ki Tov, Ki Liolam Chazdo. Since it's forever, it's Tov. Ain Tov Ela Torah. Torah is eternal, and therefore Torah is called Tov. Vayar Elokim Es Ha'or Ki Tov. The only thing it says Tov directly in Maaseh Bereishis is that or, that light, that exists forever. That or shall shiva shimei bereishis. That spiritual light. Because everything else is physical, material, and therefore limited. It's not eternal. And therefore it doesn't say ki tov directly on those things. It says vayar lokim ki tov. It doesn't say vayar lokim es hadagim ki tov. Only vayar lokim es ha'or ki tov. So tov has the connotation of something that's viable. Something that can continue to exist. In that respect, I think the Rashbam says the following. In that context, this is the way I understand it. You can look it up yourself. You may see something different there, but this is the way I understand it. Hiding Moshe Rabbeinu, hiding that little baby, put the entire family in jeopardy. Because if you tried to countermand Paro's decree, it was punishable by death. Right? It doesn't say that anywhere, but it's obvious. Paro did not take a liking to people who didn't keep his commands. So if they found a family hiding a baby, probably the entire family would be imprisoned, killed, whatever. So it was a danger to hide a baby. Moshe Rabbeinu was born 3 months premature. Even in those days, a 3 month premature, even our days, a 3 month premature baby does not have too much of a chance of surviving. Okay? Even today, with all of the modern equipment, right? Still, a 3 month early baby is rarely survives. So if Moshe Rabbeinu would have been an inviable child, he wouldn't have a chance to survive. He's born 3 months early. Then it would not have been proper to risk the entire family's safety to try and save a baby. He wasn't going to make it anyway. But Vatireyu Kitov, she saw he was viable. She saw he would be able to continue to exist. He was a viable 3 month preemie. And therefore, she took the risk for the whole family of saving him, because if she didn't hide him, he definitely would have been drowned. And at least, it's only a doubt whether the family was in danger or not if they'd be found out. So that's what it means, Vatireyu Ki Tov. This concept of Tov, meaning she saw he was viable. She saw he was going to continue to exist, to survive. Okay. Any other questions? Any questions on this? We'll go to the next thing. There's a lot of... maybe we'll finish some of them, but we'll get to the next one. It says that... Vateitatzav achoso merachok. Miriam waited from afar and waited to see what was going to happen to Moshe Rabbeinu. And because she waited for her brother to see what would be with him, later on she got a schus for that. What was her schus? that the entire Jewish people waited for her later on. Okay, and didn't travel until Miriam when she was a Metzora, because she spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe Rabbeinu. So she was 7 days outside the camp, and they didn't travel till she came back. They waited for her. That was her schus. What's the connection? She waited for Moshe Rabbeinu, therefore they waited for her. What's the idea? The Medrash says that when Paro made the decree that all baby boys have to be killed, so Amram said, why are we having children? We're just having children, Paro's going to kill them. So it's better not to have children. So he divorced his wife, and the entire Jewish people followed his example, and they all divorced their wives, stopped living with their wives, and not going to have any more children. Miriam at the time was about 6 years old. And she had a nevuah that her father was going to have the Goel Yisrael. He was going to have the Redeemer. She said to her father, you're worse than Paro. Because Paro only was goes around the Zecharim, only the males. You're making sure we don't have females either. Paro's decree is maybe it'll be successful, maybe not. Maybe people will be able to hide their children from Paro and avoid the Gzeirah. But if you don't have any children, it's for sure there's not going to be any children. Your Gzeirah is for sure. If they divorce their wives and don't have children, then there's not going to be any children in Klal Yisrael. So Amram kissed her on the head, and he said, you're right. And he remarried his wife, and everybody remarried their wives, and they started having children again. And then Moshe Rabbeinu was born, and the Gzeirah was still there, and they had to hide him. And after 3 months, they couldn't hide him anymore, and his mother had to put him in the Nile. At that point, it says, Amram slapped her in the face and said, where's your nevuah? And she didn't give up. And she went and she wanted to see what was going to be. She had perfect faith. And Miriam, the same Miriam, right, was the one who put away instruments because she knew that they were going to be taken out of Mitzrayim and there was going to be a Kriyas Yamsuf and they need the musical instruments to sing Shira. What was the midah of Miriam throughout this? She didn't give up hope. She never was miyayish. She never gave up hope. And Chazal say in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, al tisyayish min apuronios. No matter how bad things are, a person should not give up hope. And just the opposite. Not giving up hope helps to secure the Yeshua. When you give up hope, that helps to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's a halacha by an Aveda, okay, which gives the idea of what Yiyush is. If you lose something, right? You lose your pocketbook. And you haven't given up hope of finding it. You're hoping that you'll look here, look there, whatever, and you're going to find it. Then the halacha is that if somebody finds it, they have to return it to you. But if you give up hope of ever finding it, then they don't have to return it. It's not yours anymore. Why? Because the fact that you have hope for it connects you to the thing. And if you give up hope, you sever your connection to that aveda. It's not yours anymore. It's hefker. So Yiyush severs your connection to the thing you're miyayish on. And therefore, if you're in a bad situation and you give up hope of a Yeshua, you basically sever yourself from that Yeshua. As long as you haven't given up hope, you're still connected to that salvation. You're connected to that Yeshua. With that, I wanted to explain a very difficult Chazal. Chazal say that Mashiach will not come until people are miyayish from it. Shlosh dvarim boim behesach hadas, and one of them is Mashiach. L'chora, Klal Yisrael are going to give up for Mashiach to come? We're not going to believe anymore Mashiach, and that's when it's going to come? That's absurd. We have a mitzvah, achakelo b'chol yom sheyovo. What it means is that people think sometimes they can bring the Yeshua. They can bring the Geula. As long as you have that thought that you haven't given up hope of bringing it yourself, then you have a connection to it. And the final geula is going to come directly from the Rabbanu Shel Olam. Because all the previous geulas came through the agency of human beings, and therefore they weren't eternal. But if it comes directly from the Rabbanu Shel Olam without any intermediary, not a Moshe, not an Aaron, not an Esther and a Mordechai, directly from the Rabbanu Shel Olam, then it'll be eternal. So before Mashiach can come, Klal Yisrael have to give up hope of bringing it themselves, because not giving up hope of bringing it yourself connects you to it. And then it's not directly from the Rabbanu Shel Olam. There's some kind of intermediary here. So in order for Mashiach to come and be everlasting, Klal Yisrael are going to have to give up hope of bringing it on their own. They're going to have to believe that the Rabbanu Shel Olam will bring it. And they didn't give up hope that the Rabbanu Shel Olam will bring it. But they gave up hope of them bringing it through their own means. Therefore, in the Midbar, once there was the Chet HaMeraglim, and people were what's it called, every time they stopped in the Midbar was a danger that people would give up hope of ever getting to Eretz Yisrael. Right? They could have made it to Eretz Yisrael in 11 days, and now they're schlepping along in the Midbar 40 years from one place to another. And every time there's another delay, it just makes people give up hope. We're never going to get there. So the Chara, here there was a 7-day delay because of Miriam. The danger that the people would again have a reason to give up hope was great, but not for Miriam. Since Miriam exhibited the midah of never giving up hope, she stood there and watched and knew that her nevuah would be miskayim, not like her father. She didn't give up hope. Since Miriam was the epitome of not giving up hope, Klal Yisrael could wait for her. Because she could not be the source of people being miyayish because of another delay in the Midbar, since she was the epitome of not giving up hope. So therefore, in that schus that she waited for her brother, Klal Yisrael waited for her later on to what's it called, until she came back to the camp. Okay. Okay. Moshe Rabbeinu, either his mother called him this name or Bas Paro called him this name, was called Moshe. Ki min amayim mishisihu. Since he was drawn from the water, he was called Moshe. So everybody asks, if he was drawn from the water, he should have been called Moshui, the one who was drawn. Moshe means the one who's going to draw other people. So they say that, first of all, there was a little bit of Ruach HaKodesh, that he would save other people from water by Yam Suf. But more than that, if somebody is Zoche to a Yeshua, something happens to them and a nace happens to them, then that means that the Rabbanu Shel Olam has a purpose for them to serve, and therefore they were saved on credit. If they didn't deserve it at the time, then it gives them a responsibility to deserve that nace in the future. So Moshe Rabbeinu, because he was Moshui min Hamayim, he was a Moshe, he's going to have to save other people too. If something happens to you that you're Zoche, then it's a sign that you have to mezaka other people too. Right? If you don't deserve the Yeshua, right? Not Moshe Rabbeinu is a little baby. He couldn't have done anything to deserve it. Then that means that it was given to him on credit. And the credit was that he is going to now have to pay for it by helping other people. If the Rabbanu Shel Olam saved you, it means that he has a mission for you. You now have an achrayus. I wanted to say that that's the meaning of the bracha of Gomel. Hagomel lechayovim tovos shigmolani kol tov. So the simple meaning, if you look in the art scroll, probably it says that. Hagomel lechayovim, that really I was guilty and I should not have gotten through this tzara. Whether it's a sickness that a person makes it on, or a trip in a dangerous place, really I was chayev and I shouldn't have made it through. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu does good things to chayovim, to people who are guilty, and did me a very big favor, which I didn't deserve. Okay. The only problem is you're not allowed to say such a thing. Al tiftach pe l'satan. Person's not allowed to say, oi, I'm guilty, I should have been whatever, because then the Rabban Hashem takes a look at your record and he says, you know what, you're right. So maybe you shouldn't have been saved. So you're not allowed to be poseach pe l'satan, and that's called pischon pe l'satan. So how do you make a bracha like that? Hagomel l'chayovim tovos. I'm going to say it means something different. Chayiv can mean guilty. Chayiv can also mean responsible. You're chayiv in something. Hagomel l'chayovim tovos. If the Rabban Hashem gave you a special favor, then it's because, then it's mechayiv you. It obligates you to be able now to take your life and use it for the sake of other people too. Because unless you 100% deserve that, the Rabban Hashem gave it to you on credit that you should deserve it in the future. So therefore you have to do something with it. If the Rabban Hashem saved your life, it's because he wants you to use that life in a similar way for the sake of other people. So you're a chayiv. You're obligated. That's what it means, not guilty. Hagomel l'chayovim tovos. The Rabban Hashem does tovos to people who are now obligated. And that's how a person has to feel. Okay, next. Pasuk says, Vayigdal hayeled, the child grew and his mother brought him back to Bas Paro. And the next pasuk says, Vayigdal Moshe. Moshe grew. So how many times did he grow? So the Ramban says the first time was physically. He grew, he matured physically, became a young boy. The second one is he matured emotionally. He was a gadol. He was a big person. Not physically, but emotionally. What made Moshe Rabbeinu mature emotionally? When did he become a gadol? How many dafim of Gemara did he learn? Then he became a gadol. What was the criteria? So the Torah says what it was. He went out to his brothers and he saw their suffering. Rashi says, Nosan Eino Velibo Lios Metzer Aleihem. He put his heart and his eyes to suffer along with them. That constitutes godless. Somebody who can empathize with other people, feel their tzar, see it and feel it. We'll see in 1 second what that means. That is a gadol. Why? Why is that the criteria of being a gadol? And what does it have to do with the people we call gedolim? L'chor, it's a different measure of who's a gadol or not, rather than who's so sensitive to the needs of other people or whatever. Rav Shimon Shkop, in his Hakdama to his Sefer Shari Yosher, poses the following question. A person has a responsibility to himself of self-concern. You have to be concerned about yourself. It is a Torah mandate. You always come first. According to the Torah, whatever it may be, you come first. If you're losing an Aveda and your Rebbe and your father or mother are losing an Aveda, you both have, you're walking your dogs and they both, what's it called, the leashes break and the dogs are running away. And that's it. You'll never find any of them. You can catch one of them. Whose do you catch? Yours. That's halacha. Avedos chakodim. If it's not you, it's a question of your parents or your Rebbe, that's a shaila who you get first. But if it's you or your parents, you or your Rebbe, you come first. If you need tzedakah, and you only have a certain amount of money, and you can use it. And if you don't have it, you're going to suffer. And if you give it to somebody else, they won't suffer, but you'll suffer. Then you take the money for yourself. You come first when it comes to tzedakah. Efes lo yeh b'cho evyon. And the same thing goes for the halacha of chayecha kodmin. You have a canteen of water, you're lost in the desert. If you drink the contents of the canteen, you'll survive. But your friend who doesn't have a canteen will die. If you share it with him, you'll both die. If you give it to him, he'll live and you'll die. What do? Drink the water. It's your canteen. Somebody has to survive. You come first. So that is a Torah mandate. You have to worry about yourself. But the Torah also mandates you have to worry about other people, not just about yourself. So how do you balance that conflict? On the one hand, self-concern, on the other hand, concern for everybody else. It's a very big conflict, many times. So he says, it's only a big conflict if you have the wrong perspective on yourself. Some people look at themselves as from their toes to their head. That's me. And everybody else out there is them. Now you have a big problem. You have to worry about you, and you have to worry about them. So how do you resolve the conflict between you and them? But some people are bigger than that. And they consider their spouse, their husband or wife, mamish part of them. Ishto kegufo, bal keishto, like one person. So if that's the case, when they're concerned about their spouse, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern. They're concerned about themselves, except themselves as two bodies. They say that Rav Aryeh Levin Zatzal, his wife once had some pains in her leg. They went to the doctor. The doctor came out and said, Rav Aryeh, what's the problem? He said, my wife's legs hurt us. That's the way a person has to feel. Right? So that doesn't hurt her, it hurts us. Right? You feel that pain. So that is what's it called, a greater person. He's two bodies. Some people realize their children are also mamish part of them. Brokaradavuam. A child is an extension of the parent. So when they're concerned about their children, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern. Except themselves now are a few bodies. Some people understand their extended family is also part of them. Ach atzmi ubesoriyata. So when they're concerned about their extended family, their brothers, sisters, cousins, uncles, it's also part of them. So now there are a lot of bodies. Some people understand their whole neighborhood is part of them. Their whole city, whole country, all of Klal Yisrael, all of the world. The more a person feels that other people are part of him and he can feel their needs and their sorrow and their happiness, then he's a big person. The small people are people who are just from their head to their toe. The more a person can empathize with other people, the bigger a person is. That's a gadol. What does it mean, nosan eino v'libo? In order to really understand the needs of others and empathize with them, not just sympathize, but feel it, you need two things. You need eyes and you need a heart. Eyes represent intellect. You have to intellectually know what a person needs and what's good for them, what's not good for them. Because sometimes if you don't have seichel and you just have a heart, you really feel for somebody. You may harm them tremendously by thinking that you're helping them. For instance, somebody's a drug addict and he's begging you to give him money so he can go buy drugs. So if you just have a heart, you'll give him the money and feel bad for him or whatever. But if you have a seichel, you'll understand better to use the money to get him into a rehabilitation, into a program to detoxify him, than to feed his habit. Right? Same thing goes for many other things. People are habitual. People who loan money never pay it back, get constantly into debt, and they ask you for a loan. You're not doing them any favor by loaning the money. The best thing would be is to somehow get them into some kind of program that will teach them how to take care of their finances and not constantly be in debt and never pay back the debts. So you have to have seichel. But if you only have seichel and you understand the needs, the real needs of people and how to deal with them, but you have no heart, then it'll be very nice. You'll make very nice, cold studies of poverty, but you'll never do anything about it. Never give a penny to tzedakah because it's all intellectual, not emotional. So nosan eino v'libo lios meitzer aleihem. You have to have eyes and a heart. Reb Shimon says that that's the meaning of the following Mishnah. Im ein ani li mili. If I don't worry about myself, who's going to worry about me? I have to worry about myself. It's a Torah mandate to be self-concerned. But kishani li atzmi, when my ani is just little me, then mo ani, that's not my ani. My ani has to encompass everybody. And you may ask, So what's the difference? It sounds like just semantics. Because you still have a conflict between this part of me or that part of me. What difference does it make if everybody's part of you, but still there are things that you have to worry about this part of you or that part of you? So what's the difference? Difference is a tremendous difference. The Chiddushei Arim explains, when Yaakov Avinu wanted to find a pillow, so there were 12 rocks that were in the possible range of those pillows. And the rocks were fighting. I want Yaakov's head on me. That means that each rock was big enough for Yaakov's head. So what did the Rabbanu Shalom do to solve the problem? He fused all the rocks together. But Lechora, now you have one gigantic rock, which is 12 times the size of Yaakov's head. Yaakov's head didn't get any bigger, and the rocks didn't get any smaller. They just got fused together. So now you have one gigantic rock that's 12 times the size of Yaakov's head. Why aren't they still fighting? I want the tzaddik on my part of the rock. Because once it's all one rock, it doesn't make a difference anymore. What difference does it make if it's on this side of me or that side of me? When it's you and me, then it's a big conflict. When it's just which part of me takes precedence, it's a much less conflict. And I want to say that the word ani symbolizes this idea. The aleph on the right of the ani is the individual. You, the individual. Aleph. The yod is the tzibur, is everybody else. The 10 is a number that represents a tzibur, a minyan. 10 is the community. 10 is all those other people out there. How do you take the individual and the community and combine them together and make them your ani? You need a nun in the middle. What's the nun? The nun is Chamishim Sharei Bina and Chamishim Sharei Tara. There's 50 gates of wisdom and 50 gates of purity. That's the Eina Velibo. The eyes, the intellect, that's the 50 gates of wisdom. And the emotion, the heart, is the 50 gates of purity. So if you have that nun in the middle, you can take the aleph and the yud and make it your ani. That's what you are. Okay. Next. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu was punished, wasn't able to have the schus of being buried in Eretz Yisrael. Because he lo hoda bi'artzo. He didn't admit to his land, because he said, he heard when they said, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu, when the Benos Yisrael said to their father, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu, so Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say anything. And because he didn't admit that he's not an Ish Mitzri, so he wasn't buried in Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, Yosef, who said, Gunov Gunafti Me'eretz O'Ivrim, he admitted where he came from. He came from Eretz Yisrael, Gunov Gunath, so he was zochet to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Very difficult chazal. First of all, Moshe Rabbeinu was born in Mitzrayim. What do you want from him? Yosef was born in Eretz Yisrael. So he admitted, I came from Eretz Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu was not born in Eretz Yisrael, he was born in Mitzrayim. He was in each Mitzri. What's there not to correct? Beyond that, Moshe wasn't even there. When they said Ish Mitzri, it's not as if he was standing there and kept quiet and didn't correct them. He wasn't there. It's the next pasuk says, Va'ayo, where is he? If he was standing right there, was Yisrael blind? Obviously he wasn't there. He said, why'd you leave him? So he wasn't there at all when they said Ish Mitzri. What do you want from him? I think the idea is, it says that not only people who are born in Eretz Yisrael are considered Israelis, but anybody who wants to be there. Meaning, Eretz Yisrael stands for a certain standards, values. Eretz Yisrael is Eretz Asher Einei Hashem Elokecha Bo, it's a holy land. A person can live in Chutz Laretz, but he can live a Eretz Yisrael Dika life with all the standards and values of what Eretz HaKodesh represents. And you can live in Eretz Yisrael, and you can live a Chutz Laretz life, what that represents. If Moshe Rabbeinu could be mistaken for an Ish Mitzri, then something's wrong. He should have stood out where they could have said, we don't know who he is, but he's surely not an Egyptian. He doesn't look like an Egyptian. If he could look like an Egyptian, they could make a mistake to think he's an Egyptian. That means that somehow he blended in. He assimilated into Mitzrayim, even Moshe at the time. And therefore, he couldn't be buried in Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't have that kesher. But Yosef, no matter where he was in Mitzrayim, he never became a Mitzri. It was clear that he was somebody different. He lived a different life, like we spoke about 2 weeks ago. He lived amongst the Egyptians, but not with them. Moshe Rabbeinu at that time was still living with them. He could be mistaken for an Ish Mitzri, then he didn't have that kesher to what Eretz Yisrael represents. And Yosef, no matter what, had that kesher, therefore he could be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Okay, I'm not going to steal time from you. We have another 7 or 8 things to talk about, but we'll find some way of stealing them into other parashios. Okay.